Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and our fantastic Monday continues. And I am really looking forward to this hour because I haven't gotten to talk to Steve Weidenkopf for a long time. Our guest today, for this hour, and our topic this hour is myths of history. And we'd love it if you'd call 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. Steve Weidenkopf is the author of The Real Story of Catholic History, Answering 20 Centuries of Catholic of Anti-Catholic Myths. He's a lecturer in church history at Notre Dame Graduate School of Christendom College, and the creator and author of Epic Journey, A Journey Through Church History, and the author of a whole bunch of other books. Steve Weidenkopf, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Si. Thanks for having me on the show. Good to see you.
Yeah, great time to be a historian. Everybody loves historians right now and history. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, we're pretty popular at this moment, yeah.
What do you make of this? As a historian, let me ask you this. Does this remind you of any other time in history? I mean, it feels like there's a very agitated and angry mood about. There seem to be real social problems that need real, genuine addressing. And then there seems to be a kind of mania to get people to hate figures from the past.
Yeah, it reminds me an awful lot of the French Revolution.
Oh, that didn't go very well.
No, it didn't end too well for those in authority, that's for sure. Even the church. Not a happy time. But just the whole general unrest and unease with how society is. Either real or perceived injustices. Back in 18th century France, as well as in our own modern day and age, and the whole destruction of property, the mob, and a desire to forge a new society with a new narrative, a new historical narrative, a new origin story.
Right.
That's very reminiscent of what we're seeing today with statues coming down left and right of historical figures. So.
Right. And that got out of hand. And these things can get out of hand. But maybe if enough people just speak in a way that's adult and responsible, it won't get out of hand. But Would you call what people are doing now with some of the history around us a mistreatment of history, an abuse of history? How would you label it?
Yes, probably all of the above. But I would also kind of add in there, I think maybe even more so an ignorance of actual history. Because I think what people are reacting to is, frankly, I think the false narrative of certain historical figures and the false narrative of certain historical events. And so that popular perception of these historical events, but in a false way, is creating this or has created actually for a while now, this angst, this again, these either real and or perceived injustices of the past. And in an effort to try to correct those real and perceived injustices of the past, people are taking to the present and they're reacting in very violent ways. It's one thing if we want to have a conversation rationally and, through proper authoritative channels, through local government, state government, federal government even, to take down statues or no longer recognize, the impact or the events of certain people because of their own past.
Right.
Then that's, it's an acceptable thing, I think. That's a rational thing. But to allow the mob, frankly, to be violent and to just destroy things, it's kind of that follows the basic premise of, two wrongs don't make a right. So there were wrongs in the past. Perhaps it was wrong to erect statuary to certain people because of that past. But now, tearing it down by violent means is not the right way to do it.
888-318-7884 is our number if you'd like to get in on our conversation with Steve Weidenkopf on the myths of history this hour. 888-318-7884. Steve, I think some people think when you talk about ignorance of history that, in the 1950s or the 1940s, we had history and civics classes, and we don't have those anymore, and that's what the problem is. But I have to say I am unsympathetic to that argument, because I think the entire modern world, in many ways, is based on the misrepresentation of history, particularly about medieval people, that the idea is that The modern world is a time of light and recovery from the darkness of the medieval period. That was never true, and it's always been the prop that made modern people feel like they were doing better than medieval people.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, there is this kind of sense, I think, of since the Enlightenment in particular, that, you know, human history is on this progression, that it's in the progression of human enlightenment, of human knowledge, and therefore what came before us, you know, was superstition, was ignorance, was, you know, the whole kind of notion that, you know, religion was what people had because they didn't have science to explain certain things.
Right.
Right. And there might be a slight element of truth to some of those, you know, that idea. But this notion that those who came before us were ignorant, were dumb, were, you know, the living in the so-called, even the name, right, the so-called Dark Ages, or even the Middle Ages, really, is a term that was created, you know, to kind of separate the time from ancient Greece and Rome to, you know, the Enlightened period of time in the 18th and 19th centuries. And there was just this kind of, you know, middle time of all these centuries where people were just dumb and ignorant, and, you know, we'll just excuse Thomas Aquinas and forget that he wrote anything, and we'll just not look at St. Albert the Great and all these other, you know, philosophers who were living at the time, and to illustrate, you know, how man still was obviously very involved in talking about history and talking about God and talking about and observing the world and developing the scientific method. All those things, creating the university, all those things happened in the Middle Ages. And in the medieval period. So there is this modern sense of superiority towards the past, which I think numbs modern society and contributes to that ignorance that I spoke of earlier. It's not always willful. In some cases, I think it is, but in other cases, I think that people just don't know because people haven't been taught.
Again, 888-318-7884, our number. We're talking about myths of history. You want to with Steve Weidenkopf, lecturer in history at Notre Dame Graduate School. Do you guys say Notre Dame or Notre Dame there? I don't.
Well, actually, no. You know, we kind of moved away from the Notre Dame part of our talk, not because we don't like Our Lady, but we refer to ourselves more now just as the Graduate School of Christendom College.
Oh, sorry about that. Graduate School of Christendom.
No, you're fine.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
About the myths of history. So maybe give us some sense of what's a myth that we take to be history these days.
Oh, geez. Well, there's a lot. Well, as you pointed out earlier, I wrote a book a couple years ago on many of these different myths. And in that book, I list 55 different ones. So, you know, we won't have the time to go through necessarily all of those. But you can kind of break them down into different time periods and categories, you know, and most people, I think, are aware of some of the big topics, you know, the Crusades, the Inquisition, Galileo, even New World missionary activity, you know, the life and times of Father Sarah, or Saint Sarah, for example, who's right. been in the news a bit recently. And even you mentioned the medieval period. Even I saw an article a couple of days ago about King Saint Louis the Ninth, where there was a petition where people are arguing to change the name of St. Louis, Missouri, and get rid of the statue. There's a big equestrian statue of King St. Louis there that they want to tear down as well. So, and again, I think that's from, you know, a misunderstanding of medieval period, a misunderstanding of who the King St. Louis the Ninth was, and obviously, you know, all these other events as well.
888-318-7884, the number. This bothers me, this attack on, I mean, you mentioned Sarah, and I didn't even realize there was an attack on St. Louis, because it seems to me that there, I mean, if at the root of this is a very serious, a killing, there was at the root of all of what's happening now is the killing of this man on the streets of Minneapolis. If you wanted to overcome racism, you'd want to be more like King Louis of France and more like Father Sarah and not less like them.
Right, exactly. But that's what, like, it speaks to what I think the anger that exists in the world today in some quarters over these historical figures kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, in that it's a misunderstanding of history, right? There's this false narrative, this false presentation of these actual men and the times in which they live, which then presents them or people come to see them as symbols of things that were wrong, right? So, for example, Father Saint Sarah is seen as somebody who is the embodiment of the enslavement of the Native Americans. He's the symbol of all that was wrong with the Spanish colonial efforts and all the wrong that the European powers did in the New World. And that's not to say that obviously there were examples of mistreatment of indigenous peoples. That's definitely true. By European colonists and settlers, right. Not necessarily by the church, and definitely not by the missionaries either, and certainly not by Saint Sarah. But again, people don't remember or know that exact history, and so, or they've been taught again a false presentation of that history. So then they think Father Sarah, Saint Sarah, is the one to blame for all of this. You know, if he wasn't directly involved in mistreatment of the Native peoples, he's at least a symbol of that mistreatment, and therefore he has to go.
Right. That's right. Because you don't have, I mean, the people who were engaged in the criminality, there aren't that many statues to them. There are statues to Father Sarah, but if you can't remember the past, you think, well, they're all the same people, just tear his statue down.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, we got to take a quick break. Steve Weidenkopf, among his many books, is The Real Story of Catholic History, Answering 20 Centuries of Anti-Catholic Myths. That is from Catholic Answers Press. You can get that right now at shop.catholic.com at savings. I don't know. I think they're taking 30% off that one. You got to put in a promo code to get the 30% off, though. And the promo code is REAL, R-E-A-L. I don't know why. I have no idea. Would they just do a random choice of words? So real is the word you got to put in to get 30% off at checkout at shop.catholic.com on Steve Weidenkopf's book. Because it's The Real Story of Catholic History. That's why it's real. Sorry, my bad. I will go be embarrassed now for a couple minutes.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Raymond Arroyo.
Part of the success we've had on the world over, I attribute to the audience, my relationship with Mother Angelica, and her teaching me that when you sit with someone, you talk to them, and you create an environment where they will tell you things they wouldn't tell anyone else. That ease, that humor, that warmth, she gave me that, and that's what I try to impart and make a part of every interview we do on the world over.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV and radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Steve Weidenkopf, author of many books and a lecturer at the graduate school at Christendom College in history. Christendom College, you should look up about them. They're a wonderful place. I've heard it's beautiful there. I've never been, so I don't. I've heard that physically it's just a beautiful campus. But I really, personally, I'm a big fan of Christendom, like the original Christendom. So I'm glad to have a place called Christendom College. And you're welcome to call with your questions about history. It's a very challenging time. History is it's such a I suppose, Steve, in a way, our even studying history is something that requires good faith on our part in our imagination, that we have to imagine people in their setting and with some compassion, so that we don't just become judgmental prudes from the future who can look back and go, you got this right and that right. You can't really do history with an ungenerous spirit.
No, you can't. And you know, part of that generous spirit, Cy, really involves trying to study people from their own perspective, right? From understanding them for who they were and the times in which they lived. You cannot really come to know historical people without knowing the times in which we're all shaped, right, by the times in which we live. And if that's true for us, it was certainly true for people before us. And so you have to understand what was going on at the time in which they lived to see how what was important to them, why they may have made the decisions that they made. And absent understanding that, you really get a false sense of who they were.
For lots of people on the phone, shall we go to the phone, Steve?
Absolutely.
That's right. All right. Let's go to, Stephen in Massachusetts, listening on the EWTN app. Stephen, very happy to have you with us. Your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
And forgive me. Thank you. You folks are a tremendous part of my life and my education that flows through to even Confraternity of Christian Doctrine classes. So,
thank you.
But looking for comments related to, the Masons and the Communists. I have five children, so I span over two decades of public and parochial, and they are the history and some of the readings required are very soft or ignorant on those influences, and very much in particular, to focus it down, and I'll stop. In the 20s in Mexico and in the 30s in Spain, those were both Mason and Communist movements, and they are not clearly identified in most history books for exactly what they are. But one can go to a secular writing, George Orwell's Ode to Catalonia, to see the communism from Spain. And we have plenty of saints pictured in both situations that went to their death at the moment of their martyrdom. So I just was looking for some comments about just the indoctrination away from truth.
Yes. Thank you, Stephen. Steve Weidenkopf.
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for your question. I mean, you're exactly right in terms of these two events that you mentioned. The persecution, really, of the church and the change in Mexico in the early 20th century when it adopted a socialist revolutionary government came to power and then enacted these series of laws. Earlier in the 20th century, in 1917, there was an amendment to the Mexican Constitution that was very anti-Catholic and anti-Christian in nature. And then, you know, for a couple of years, those laws weren't as readily implemented. But then that changed in the 20s when Calles became president of Mexico. And he really implemented these anti-Catholic decrees, and to the point where priests and bishops were expelled, they were arrested, the church was forced to go underground. It was a series of kind of edicts and implementation of these edicts, which heightened the persecution of Catholics in Mexico to the point where you have the Cristeros, response, where faithful Catholics, you know, band together with weapons to defend themselves and defend the faith. Massive examples, thousands of martyrs, perhaps one of the most famous martyrs from that Mexican period of time is Blessed Miguel Pro, a Jesuit priest who missioned to underground, clandestinely to the Catholics in Mexico, was arrested, on trumped up charges of trying to assassinate the president of Mexico, which were obviously completely false, and was then executed by a firing squad. And there's a extremely famous, picture of him right before his execution with his arms outstretched in prayer. And his last words were "Vivo Cristo Rey," right? Long live Christ the King. And, that's not, like you said, Stephen, many of those things, those events are not taught that well in our own schools, even our Catholic schools. And I think part of that goes back to what I mentioned in my book as well, is that a lot of history in the English speaking world, most of it actually, for the last 200 years or so, has been presented from an English Protestant perspective. And so Spain and Mexico, because they were fully Catholic countries, but they suffered these great socialist and communist revolutions, which were very bloody in the 20th century. They're mentioned, maybe the Spanish Civil War is mentioned from a political perspective, but the Mexican Revolution and persecution of the church is hardly mentioned at all. And I think that has a lot to do with just how Spain and Mexico and, frankly, Catholic history is presented in that English Protestant world to begin with. It's really not touched upon as being important.
That is a fascinating point. I'm going to go back to you, Stephen, if you have a follow-up for Steve Weidenkopf so you can hang on. But it is interesting in American textbooks how often the anti-Catholic forces are portrayed as the good guys. And so that even you'll get the Spanish Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, the anti-Catholics are the good guys. In Mexico, the anti-Catholics are the good guys. It had never occurred to me before where to lay the blame for that there's an American anti-Catholicism, that Americans, there's a deep American anti-Catholicism. Stephen, are you satisfied with Steve's answer to you?
Yes, I could go on for hours. Look from a basis of truth. That's then you represent it constantly every day your show is aired. And realize you also are in recording, but you're aired in Britain and Ireland. So I'm happy to also hear different points of the day on, in recording for us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have the EW10 does a wonderful job in the British Isles. They have a whole project to get us over there, and we're very grateful for that. And we're on all across Asia as well, and that's why I like to use the phrase evil communist dictators when I talk about the rulers of China, because there is a way in which communists get a pass, and they're extremely anti-religious and anti-Catholic everywhere they are, but they get a pass. And so I'm glad to have your call, Stephen. I mean, the worst human rights abuse of the last 50 years is the one-child policy in China, and it's treated as if it's nothing here in America. We just report on it as if it's nothing, and it's certainly comparable to the horrors that have been experienced, the great horrors of the 20th century. Stephen, I'm so grateful for your call. Thanks. And I'm going to keep using the word evil communist dictators to talk about the people who run China. And that is out of love for the Chinese people. I mean, this great Chinese culture so oppressed by communism. Dan in Minnesota, you're next. Dan's watching on Facebook Live. Steve Weidenkopf is our guest. Dan, go ahead with your question.
Gentlemen, thanks for taking my question. You know, we have a real problem with sort of a mixed groups of people in this country, you know, and one got, you know, the incredible head start and the other did not, you know, and the African-American community was essentially stripped of any cultures that they might have had or brought with them when they left the continent. So for me, that begs the question, you know, what sort of, speaking of cultural artifacts in particular, what sort of cultural olive branch could be given in terms of representation, statuary, et cetera. Could there be one? It does bring to mind, just briefly before I wrap up that question, that, you know, in ancient Egypt, the empires sometimes would solve those inter-ethnic, inter-religious community disputes by essentially making syncretism, that they would incorporate one another's religions and one another, you know, the ruling group would incorporate elements of the lower groups, religion and culture in kind of the mainline representations in society and statuary, et cetera. So I wonder what you think of that question. What could be done in America?
Yeah, this is the good luck. Could you please solve racism, yeah. Steve Weidenkopf?
Yeah. One word, love. Yeah.
Oh, you know, praise God.
I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, that's what we're called to do, right? I mean, frankly, this is a little bit out of my lane, I guess, but just my personal opinion is, you know, we can't solve the evils, the moral evils of the world, right, by legislation. You really can't. I mean, and through social policy. I mean, you can affect things, you can modify behavior to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, how you really eradicate these things is through the living of virtues, frankly, and Christian virtues in particular. And I think definitely charity, right? The extension of love, this of fundamentally seeing each other as what our faith teaches us, that we are all created in the image and likeness of God. We are all brothers and sisters in Christ, and we are called to try to extend love to everyone we come into contact with, not just in our own family. And for the Christian in particular, especially the baptized Christian, right, the baptized Christians, we are called to, in our vocation, to image forth Christ in the world. Right? We're called to embody the words of St. John the Baptist, who said, I must decrease and he, meaning Christ, must increase. And so if people are not seeing Christ when they see us, then we're doing something wrong, right? And thankfully, we have the sacrament of confession. So when those times may fall, we can go and do that. But that's how we solve it, right? To not see each other in these fault lines and in these groups and whatnot, but to try to understand the other person, to understand their perspective. As you point out, Dan, you know, there is room in our American society for some level of representation and statuary of you know, non-European contributors to American society? Absolutely there is. And there should be, frankly. And if that hasn't happened heretofore, then perhaps maybe one of the positive things that can come out from all of this unrest and whatnot is maybe a rational conversation about that and the institution of those kinds of things. So
could I just add a small thing to that? Something that my good friend Deacon John always says is you can't love each other if you don't know each other. And if you don't know any black people, if you're a white person, and if you don't know any white people, if you're a black person, you cannot love each other. You can't. Love is not a theory. It's not a theoretical feeling that you have. It has to be practical. I have to say, David, and I'll say this, Dan, and to you, Steve, one of the things that has impressed me so much on the news coverage about all this racial strife that we're going through is seeing people like the mayor of Houston or the acting police chief in Atlanta or some other, like you see these incredibly capable and good, devoted African-American men and women, and you go, where are these people the rest of the time? Why aren't they on TV all the time? Why did we have to wait till now to find out that we have this magnificent man as the mayor of Houston? And I'm going to blame the same people I always blame, cable news. I'm going to blame cable news. Come on! Why do we have to wait for there to be riots in the streets before we show the brilliance of and devotion of these black public servants, African-American public servants all around the country? Steve Weidenkopf is our guest. Lots of more people on the phone. But if you want to talk about myths of history with Steve Weidenkopf, give us a call, 888-318-7884.
Hi, this is Bishop James Wall from the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Shame, Shame, Shame.
We'll help you overcome unhealthy guilt and shame.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now, back to Catholic Answers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As we live in a time of purging ourselves of statues, some of which, as I appreciate that our guest Steve Weidenkopf said this. He's the author of The Real Story of Catholic History, and we're talking with Steve Weidenkopf about myths of history this hour. If you want to call 888-318-7884, some of those statues should come down. And you said that before. I mean, there should have been it shouldn't have got to this point with some of these statues.
No, and you know, there's a whole history behind. And, I mean, the other part of it is trying to understand why were these statues put up of various peoples, and when were they put up? There's a whole story and historical context behind each of those, and it's important to know that, right? And to understand why they were put up, and maybe they shouldn't have been put up in the first place.
Right, right. But the incivility of our time is really kind of frightening. It really is kind of a frightening time. All right, we're straightening out myths of history. If you got any, 888-318-7884. David in San Antonio, Texas is next. David listening on Guadalupe Radio. Hi, David. Your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Hello, thank you. Yes, I want to know, like, when did the Catholic Church begin to use the word Easter, as in for the resurrection? And what was the process? Where did they come up with that? I was saying, like, Happy Easter to certain people. And I came across some friends that are Protestants, and they said that we derived it from a pagan festival back in the old times. And I haven't found any information to help me answer that question yet. So,
well, let me just say, these friends of yours sound like a lot of fun. But Steve, give us the what's the problem with saying Happy Easter?
Yeah. Oh, there's no problem with saying Happy Easter. Yeah. No, actually, there's a to our caller, I do cover this whole question of was Easter borrowed from a pagan holiday. In my book, The Real Story of Catholic History. But to give you the brief synopsis on that, really, part of the problem that people run into with the whole Easter thing and pagan thing is language, right? So we kind of sometimes have this false perception that, the church used English from the very beginning, right? That the apostles and everybody were speaking English. They weren't speaking different languages, right? That Easter came into the English language at some point, right? So, and actually the word for Easter, the celebration of Jesus's resurrection, in Romance-based languages, French, Italian, Spanish, is really modeled after the Greek Pascha for Passover, which is what the feast the Jews were celebrating at the time of Jesus's crucifixion and death and resurrection. And it's only in English that we have this kind of different word that we use for it. And so many people think, or some theories abound, that this first started to be used around the 6th century, that the English historian St. Bede, who wrote a work called On the Reckoning of Time, was the first one to kind of use this word called Estermoth, which could roughly be translated into modern English as Easter. And he says, Bede says, that this word comes from, it's an Anglo-Saxon word that was used to denote a Germanic goddess of light and of springtime, that she was associated with that time of year in the month of April. But what's odd about that is that Bede, although Bede mentions that, he's the only author that we have for that period of time that actually uses that word. So there's only one reference to it. But what's even more behind, whether the word is based on Greek or whether it's based on a Germanic word or what word we use, I think for our caller, what you need to kind of go back with your friends at is what's behind the questioning of it, right? I mean, why are we questioning when the Christians celebrate Easter? I mean, they did so from the very beginning. And that's clearly indicated in all the documents of the early church. There was a big to-do in the early church about the dating of Easter. So that's really what's more important. What's celebrated, not what word we use to describe it.
How's that, David?
I mean, that's kind of good. I mean, I did allude to that in the conversation. I mean, and so, like, even in their preference, they would just prefer to use Happy Resurrection. That's fine with me. I mean, that was common ground. And I was just listening.
Well, if they said that, what you should probably say is, look, happy is an Enlightenment term. Joyous resurrection is what you mean to say. You don't want to be using terms from the Enlightenment. I'd be happy with happy resurrection.
Joyful resurrection. Well,
yeah. The Lord is really risen, and that is something we share. Yeah. That the joy of that is something we share with every Protestant person. But as Steve was saying, it's awful thin, the historical evidence that any of this comes from paganism.
Correct. So when did the Catholic Church start using Happy Easter or Easter as like one of the seasons?
Well, at least since Bede then, right?
Well, the word itself in English, yeah. But I mean, before that, the church had celebrated English, obviously, from apostolic times, from the very beginning. And as I mentioned, in the second century, for example, there was a big question. The question in the early church wasn't whether to celebrate Easter or what Easter represented or even what word to use to celebrate the event. The question in the early church was, well, when do we date it? Right? Because there was a difference that developed in the eastern part of the church, the western part of the church, of how do we determine what day to celebrate Easter? Because it was all tied to Passover initially, right? And so in the eastern part of the church, the dating was you celebrated Easter on whatever day of the week it happened to fall based on you know, the Jewish rendering of Passover. So if Easter fell on Tuesday, then you celebrate Easter on Tuesday. Whereas in the Western part of the church, you know, the from Rome and others, they took the position that Easter should always be on Sunday, because that's when that's the actual day of the week that Christ rose from the dead, on a Sunday. So Easter should always be on a Sunday, regardless of when Passover is. So you take whatever the date is for Passover, and then you move Easter to that Sunday. That was the big question.
David, going to leave it there. Thank you very much for the call. We're talking about myths of history in this time where we are very history challenged as a people, but we're also posing a challenge to our own history, that we're making judgments about the past in some ways that I would suggest rashly and irrationally in some cases today. We're doing that. In other cases, I'm sure that the judgments that are being made are helpful. But all that will have to sort itself out. Up next, Ryan in Lansing, Michigan, listening on AM 990. Ryan, delighted to have you. Your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to ask, there's a whole slew of historical figures that I just don't know. I was never really exposed to, even until like around college or even after college. And one of those is Saint Bartolome de las Casas, and even Dorothy Day, she's not a saint, but there's
I don't
a
know.
Whole
Wait,
history
wait,
of,
hang on a quick second. Bartolome de las Casas, I don't think he's a saint.
Not a saint.
No, he's a bishop of southern Mexico, but I don't think a saint. Go ahead, Ryan.
I'm sorry. Nope. Okay, I'm sorry. But yeah, I was just wondering, like, I mean, there's a whole history there that I would love to see statues, or maybe not even statues, but just, I guess if they're not saints, but just discussion of on our part and about how the Africans were taken, forcibly taken from their country, and about how our country, okay, I'm kind of maybe going off topic, but go ahead.
Well, no, I don't know that you are. We do have Saint Martin de Porres, right? But and there are others who were saints who were very much involved in trying to. And you mentioned de las Casas, mostly with people native to the Americas, but were very much involved in the idea of that people needed to be treated with dignity at the very least. That's what Jesus wanted. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just add to this. I mean, that's the whole point, really, of Catholic missionary activity, that even from the very beginning, right, the church is a missionary church, and the church is supposed to carry the gospel throughout the world. And when you study the history of the various missionaries throughout the church's history for 2,000 years, what you find is a central theme, and we hit on it before the break with the one caller, that all these missionaries were rooted in love. I mean, they were their whole purpose for going and trying to spread the gospel in the New World, in parts of Europe, in parts of Asia, all over the world, was focused on charity, and it was focused because they loved God, they loved Christ so much that they heard of these people in these other areas of the world who hadn't received the good news. And so out of love for them and concern for their eternal salvation, these missionaries went to those areas. People like St. Francis Xavier, for example, to Japan and off the coast of China, India. You know, you see the North American martyrs, for example, the French Jesuits who missioned in what is modern day upstate New York and in modern day Canada and Quebec. People like St. Isaac Jogues, St. Jean de Brebeuf, those men. They were all motivated. You read their writings, even St. Sarah, who we talked about earlier, you read their writings, and they are focused on charity, on love. They want to, they don't want to abuse the native peoples. And when colonists did, especially in the southwest of the United States, and in the Caribbean, and in Central South America, you had people like Bartolomé de las Casas, people like St. Peter Claver, people like
St. Peter Claver, yes.
St. Peter Claver, others that stood up and spoke out against the harsh treatment that the colonial authorities the colonists enacted upon the native peoples. And they were very incensed and upset by that. And that comes clearly out. But the problem is, as we spoke of earlier in the hour, more people are apt to kind of believe the false narrative that they've been given about these individuals as symbols of the church's autocratic principles or the church's intolerance of others, instead of actually taking the time to read their writings and seeing what these men actually and these women actually did do.
Ryan, how's that for you?
Go ahead.
There's a whole false history there. I agree.
Yeah, I think that's what Steve has dedicated his life to correcting, really, is that there's a false history. That's exactly right. One of the things that really impresses me when I'm in some certain southern states like Louisiana is that the Knights of Peter Claver are all over the place. And this is a wonderful organization, and people should find more about it. I want to mention a new American saint, Stanley Rother. Someone who gave his life in Guatemala for the people of Guatemala, Father Stanley Rother. You mentioned Dorothy Day. Did you want to say anything else about Dorothy Day? I only say that because I used to be a Catholic worker. So anybody who mentions Dorothy Day gets extra time. Did you want to say anything else about Dorothy Day, Ryan?
There's just this whole history, and I would love for it to be taught like in CCD or in Catholic schools, or just I never even knew about it until I was out of college. You know, when I was, a little bit, and I was helping out around the local, local parish and all that, and, learning about theology of the body. I never knew all this existed until after that. So,
you are having the same moment of the light bulb going off that we try to get everybody to have here, because I think I have had that light bulb go off. Steve, maybe you did too. At some point where you go, wait a second, there's a whole set of lies about the Catholic Church, a lot of them taught in Catholic schools, that you just got to move past because it's not true. Well, I'll just say this about Dorothy Day because you didn't want to mention her anymore. She was, in fact, a communist. Well, no, she wasn't a communist. She was an anarchist, all right? But she loved communists, but she got over it. That's why we love Dorothy Day. By the time she's about 60 or 70, she got over it. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk about the real history with a historian, Steve Weidenkopf. He's the author of many fine books of history, including The Real Story of Catholic History, Answering 20 Centuries of Anti-Catholic Myths. It's exciting to get to hear the sound in Ryan's voice of going, wait a second, there's something good about this Catholic faith. Who knew? It's not just good. It's a great and glorious history. We all have to move past the fake stories, the anti-Catholic stories. We'll do more of that when we come back right after this. Hi, this is Cy. I'm really proud of the two episodes of Catholic Answers Focus that we have for you this week. And if you haven't yet become a subscriber to our free podcast, this is definitely the week you should start. Monday, we've got an interview with Father Hugh Barber about the relationship between your soul and the Blessed Trinity. How is it that the triune God relates to your soul? Talk about news you can use. And Wednesday, we tackle Christopher Columbus with the world's leading Columbus scholar, Dr. Carol Delaney. Is it time to give up on Columbus? In the light of modern scholarship, should we be taking down Columbus statues and murals? Prepare to be surprised by the truth of the man. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Focus wherever you get your podcasts or listen anytime at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
You have just a beautiful compassion and an affirmation of every caller. You zone right in to each person's need, and then you ask all of us to pray for that person, and I do. I just think you really, really have a great ministry. You just really are tonic and concentrated multiple vitamins for all of us spiritually.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our number is 888-318-7884. You know, we haven't heard from too many people who wanted to challenge our take on history. And by our take, I mean Steve Weidenkopf's take, which I wholly endorse in every way because he actually knows the facts. I just have the feelings. But if you want to talk with Steve Weidenkopf, historian Steve Weidenkopf, who lectures in history at the graduate school at Christendom College, one of those institutions that is kind of a recovery operation, meaning it's trying to recover the lost history, the lost values, the lost philosophy and theology, all those things of the Catholic tradition. Wouldn't you say that's true of Christendom College?
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's our fundamental mission. I mean, our university was founded, our college was founded, rather, by Dr. Warren Carroll, who was a historian, and that was his main focus was on retelling or presenting accurately the history of Christendom, of the Catholic Church, and the Western civilization as a whole, frankly.
And I think one of the reasons why we get callers like the last caller we have who are surprised to find out the truth about the Catholic faith, whether it's the moral teaching, the sexual teaching, the historical truth of the Catholic faith, is that we have a lot of Catholic institutions of learning that are failing in their task. And so you've had people like, I'm just going to name a few, but places like Franciscan University at Steubenville, Thomas Aquinas College out here in California, John Paul the Great Catholic University, University of Dallas, Ave Maria, and Christendom College, among others. I hate to make a list because there are many other fine examples. But there do seem to be people who are dedicated to actually recovering the truth about what the Catholic faith is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's as you pointed out, it's a needed mission and needed goal of our current world, right?
Really is.
Because of some of these other bigger universities that were, you know, first originally Catholic, have kind of moved away, or not really kind of, but have moved away in many instances from that fundamental mission of presenting their curriculum through the lens of the truth, right? Yeah. Because if we're Catholics, we believe that, you know, Christ had the fullness of his revelation, the fullness of his sacraments, the fullness of his grace subsists within the Catholic Church. And if you believe that fundamentally, then everything you teach, you know, whether it's biology or history or philosophy, should imbue that basic principle. And not every Catholic university in America can say that it does that right now.
No, but there is a chance that they'll come back. I mean, there's a chance of recovery.
Yep.
Probably not at Georgetown, but oh wait, I shouldn't have said that out loud. Sorry. Yeah, Frank in Indianapolis. I'm going to get in trouble now. Sorry. Listening on the EWTN app. You are next, Frank. Your history question for historian Steve Weidenkopf.
Yes, thank you for doing the studies that you do and all the historians out there that are Catholic, because otherwise the rest of us wouldn't know what, you know, aren't learning all these historical facts. But there's one that I was curious about because I've heard on Al Crest and other places where they talked about Roosevelt, and then today, surprisingly, hearing the protesters taking down President Roosevelt, I don't understand why they would want to take him down.
Is that must be Teddy Roosevelt? Is that we're talking about President Theodore Roosevelt, not Franklin?
Okay.
Is that right? I'm just clarifying, but. I don't think people are tearing down Franklin Roosevelt's statue. Or am I mistaken, Steve?
No. I think that's right. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt is at least that's the article that I saw just this morning, that there's an equestrian statue, I guess, of Teddy Roosevelt somewhere in New York City. And he's on a horse. But my understanding is that on either side of him, there's an African portrayed. And then on the other side, there's a Native American portrayed. So in kind of a very subservient, derogatory way, really, I guess, to put it out there. So I think people have been calling actually for the removal of that particular statue in New York City for a while. And just I think because of all the other statuary coming down throughout the country now, that's getting wrapped up in the most recent thing. But, you know, but again, Roosevelt, and I'm not, you know, my specialty is not in American history. It's more medieval and other history, but in ecclesiastical history. But, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is a very controversial figure in many, many ways. I mean, he did, you know, some good things, I guess, for America, one could say, but he also was very violent, was very, you know, utilized in his policy, his foreign policy was a bit heavy-handed, one could say. And I think that he may have been wrapped up in some of that late 19th century, early 20th century, you know, racial theories and superiority of you know, European culture and civilization and things like that in a very negative way is what I mean. So
is this one of those situations that you were kind of alluding to before, Steve, where we don't necessarily want to defend the statue, but we do want to defend civility in regard to these things. I don't know how else to put it, but is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, I think that there should be a rational conversation about statuary and who it is that we want to create statues for and who we want to celebrate as a nation, or even as a city, as a locale, whatever, you know, the way that our country is set up. And as I mentioned earlier, there is always a story behind these particular statues. I mean, they're not created in a vacuum. So they're created in a historical period of time, usually, obviously, much, you know, in many decades or centuries past when the person actually lived. And they are, you know, many times created for political purposes, right, or for societal purposes. There's a specific purpose behind why the statuary is made and why it's put where it is. So I think instead of just ripping these statues down kind of willy-nilly or not even willy-nilly, with, you know, violently with a mob, we need to re-engage the converse or have a conversation about that. What's the history of the statues? Why are they there? What are they representing? And what do we as a people, as a nation, as a community, who do we want to celebrate? I think those are all, you know, legitimate questions to have, but that, as you point out, Si, they should be done in a civil manner.
I have to say, though, like, if I were, if you put yourself in the place of, say, the African-American mom or dad who's just going to walk their kid by wherever that statue is every day, if it's a humiliating depiction of an African-American man or woman, you want the statue gone. That you don't want your kid to see that every day.
Right. Yes. There should never be anything derogatory or demeaning in these statues. And in that case, I think with Teddy Roosevelt, that at least that's what the critics have said about it, is that that's definitely how it's portrayed.
Frank, what do you make of that answer? Did we get to what you wanted to get to?
Yeah. Well, I also was thinking maybe it might have some of the characteristics of socialism and communism mixed in there somewhere, possibly because what happened to the Cristeros in Mexico. That's why I was wondering, like, if something, there's like a linkage in there or something of that sort, because of the communism that was going on with the Presidente Calles and with the Cristeros. So I'm thinking possibly maybe it was just a flavoring of communism and socialism in there.
In with Teddy Roosevelt, do you mean?
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking, somewhere, or the other president was there, I think, I can't remember his name.
Franklin Roosevelt, yeah. That might be more apt for Franklin Roosevelt than for Teddy. He was probably an anti-communist. He was certainly in those days, the word anarchist was common, and he would have been an anti-anarchist, a violent one, as a matter of fact.
Right, I think Teddy Roosevelt was president much earlier than that, too. He was president in the early 20th century. So It was even before these things happened in Mexico. And,
right.
And you know, and maybe Franklin Roosevelt, you know, with the alliance with Stalin in the Second World War. I mean, that was more out of necessity to obviously get rid of Hitler and Nazism than it was to promote communism.
There was a certain element, though, in the administration of Franklin Roosevelt, not himself personally, but during those years, of a growing kind of tolerance, or I mean, you think about the Rosenbergs and some of the things that went on. There was certainly some communist sympathy in some parts of the U.S. government at the time.
Oh, very true. Yeah, that's very true. You're right. Yes.
And we've got to have no sympathy for communism. That's the rule. Steve Weinkopf is our, the great fighter against the kind of inhuman policies of communism has been the Catholic Church right from the beginning. Is that a fair thing to say, actually?
Yep. No, that's a very fair thing to say. I mean, even from the very beginning with the Bolshevik Revolution in the early 20th century, the popes have consistently and constantly from that time on, you know, and even a little before that, really, you know, criticized communists and socialistic political philosophy, political ideals. St. John Paul II, obviously, was the great fighter of communism in our own day and age. And, you know, we need more statues of St. John Paul II throughout the country, frankly.
Yeah.
But that's a conversation for another day and age.
Right. And then in a generation, they can rip them down. Well,
let's hope not.
Well, you never know. I mean, it just seems like we're a little bit out of, we've already talked about it. There's a fever right now. And it's it may have some healthy elements to it, to the corrective impulse, but it has gotten unhealthy.
Absolutely. I agree. Absolutely.
Steve, thanks for doing the hour with us. I know you have a new book coming out later in the year, maybe December. We'll have you back at least then, maybe before that, but at least when your new book comes out, we'll do an hour on that, I hope. And for now, I hope people will get the real story of Catholic history, answering 20 centuries of anti-Catholic myths. This is one of those books that I leave around, and when people see it, they always pick it up. Oh, I got to see what's in here. So you should have this book around. You can get it at shop.catholic.com. Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum, Jimmy Akin. Again, a great thank you to C. Weidenkopf for all your great work in recovering the truth. May God bless you in it and Christendom College, and we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.